Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper with the Public Policy Channel, and today I'm pleased to welcome Stephanie DeLuca. Stephanie is the co-author with Susan Clampett Lundquist and Catherine Eden of Coming of Age in the Other America, published in 2016 by the Russell Sage Foundation. Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So before we turn our attention, to the book itself, I wonder if you might talk just a little bit about your own background and perhaps what it is that led you to this particular project.
Sure. So I had the good luck of showing up in graduate school at just the right time. It was about 20 years after a major desegregation program was launched in Chicago that gave public housing residents, African-American public housing residents, a chance to leave Chicago's high-rise housing projects and in inner-city high-poverty neighborhoods and move to more affluent suburbs in the outlying counties. About 7,000 African-American families moved between roughly the late 70s through the early 90s. And when I showed up in graduate school, it was about 15 to 20 years later. And with my advisor, Jim Rosenbaum, I had a chance to see what had happened to these families and really look at the question of whether it's not just the family you're born into that shapes your life, but whether it's also the neighborhood you grow up in. And so We did a series of papers looking at the outcomes for children who had left high poverty neighborhoods and moved to more affluent neighborhoods, as well as their parents. In the background of all of this, there was a lot of fair housing activity. Obviously, there was a fair housing case, the Gautreaux case, that led to this program in the 60s that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And public housing residents had were suing HUD and the Chicago Housing Authority for essentially isolating public housing residents in the most racially segregated, economically disadvantaged communities in the city. And the plaintiffs won the case, and the remedy was the provision of vouchers to move to these more affluent neighborhoods in mostly white suburbs. So in the mix of all of this, some of the early findings were quite promising, and that led HUD, in addition to the fair housing community, to say whether, maybe we should do this in more places. Maybe this should be expanded. The idea that housing policy could be a lever for social mobility, the idea that housing policy could be social policy, could be health policy at the time. HUD, with the urging of researchers like Jim Rosenbaum, decided to launch a 5-city study of housing opportunity with a more rigorous design, an actual experiment, not just what we thought of as a natural experiment, which was the fair housing remedy, but an actual sort of gold standard random assignment controlled field trial. And this was legislated and supported by Congress in fiscal year 92-93, and then launched between 1994 and 1998 in 5 cities: LA, Boston, New York, Chicago, and Baltimore, to sort of test the idea that neighborhoods matter and that the fortunes of some of our most vulnerable families would change if they got a chance to leave neighborhoods that William Julius Wilson and Doug Massey and Nancy Denton had all, by the late 80s, early 90s, said were toxic to child well-being and an impediment to racial relations and social mobility in America. So I showed up in graduate school in 1997 in time to study the effects of the Gautreaux program, and then showed up in Baltimore right in time to figure out what had happened with some of the Moving to Opportunity families. So the program, this 5-city program that got launched, was known as Moving to Opportunity. So I sort of had these two really serendipitous moments that had nothing at all to do with whether I was talented in any way. And I tell my graduate students and my undergraduate students, sometimes this is about being in the right place at the right time and working really, really hard. So I just happened to get a job. So I left graduate school at Northwestern in Chicago and moved to Baltimore right around the time that it had been 4 to 7 years after the Moving to Opportunity experiment had been launched. And The short story, well, the long story short, actually, is that the moving to opportunity experiment had showed in this interim evaluation period sort of mixed to disappointing findings compared to the Chicago Gautreaux program, which was a resounding success in many people's eyes as a way to help poor Black families leave ghetto neighborhoods and have children enter better schools and do better. Mothers were more likely to work after they moved. You know, the New York Times hailed the Gautreaux program as the new Underground Railroad. I mean, there was a lot. Phil Donahue and others had, you know, had participants of the program on. And then, you know, MTO was launched, and we call the Moving to Opportunity Program for short. MTO was launched 1994 to 1998, 4 to 7 years later, there are these mixed results that suggest children weren't doing any better in school when they had a chance to move to a less poor neighborhood. Mothers were no more likely to be employed or less likely to be receiving welfare subsidies. Mm-hmm. Boys were more likely to get in trouble in low poverty neighborhoods. But there was a sort of a surprise positive finding in all of this, which is that mothers and daughters experienced mental health benefits on par with best practices and antidepressant medication therapies, which was a surprise. So this was kind of a mixed story. So what happened is when I showed up in Baltimore in 2002, Greg Duncan, Jeff Kling, and Kathy Eden had decided to launch a fieldwork study to figure out why these findings were so confusing. What happened? So that's my entry point into a study that would then last a decade and result in coming of age. We started out being interested in a housing experiment and the role of neighborhoods, but it became so much more than that.
So, I mean, that's perfect segue bringing us into the book. Can you talk first a little bit about the study itself? Can you talk a little bit about sort of the methods in your approach, and then we'll turn our attention to what it is that you all discovered?
Sure. So, you know, we did a couple of different things with the book. We started the fieldwork in 2003 here in Baltimore and interviewed mothers in primary caregivers in 150 families in Baltimore who had signed up for the MTO program. We also interviewed young adults in some of those families and some teachers and tried to get a sense of sort of what happened with their experience with the program and maybe what were some things, you know, that were anticipated that didn't come through and all that. So then, you know, we wrote a series of papers about that, but decided to keep going back and finding out how, for example, the children who were 0 to 10 when their parents signed up for MTO were faring as they began to transition into their own adulthood around 2010. They were about 15 to 24 years old at this point, and we went back in deeply during that time between about 2010 and 2013 and talked to 150 young adults who some of these young adults we had interviewed parents and older siblings for earlier, you know, in the 2003 study, but many we had met for the first time because they were young in the early part of the study. And, you know, we spent time in their lives, right, in their communities, in their homes, in their spaces, in part to continue to understand the importance of neighborhoods, but also, I guess you could say, to try to get a sense of what the inner life of the inner city is like. What's it like to come up in a place like Baltimore? And what's special about our approach is we did what we call narrative interviewing, sort of in-depth interviews with young people that say, tell me your story. Mm-hmm. Welcome me, you know, welcome me into your world so that I can be a student and you be the expert. Many of these young people had never had anyone sit down and ask them these questions. And we were asking about, you know, educational transitions, of course, and work and family and risk behavior and all of that. But that we were also looking, you know, to hear them talk about meaning and, you know, how they make sense of their world. And so our approach was primarily interview based, but we also, spent time in, you know, more ethnographic mode, hanging out in, you know, parks and visiting the, you know, the doctor for a sonogram, moving one young man in with his girlfriend at their first apartment. So we, you know, we took that approach. And what we were able to do then is take advantage of the earlier data on these families a decade before, the data we collect on these young adults, and some of the data from the MTO survey. So it was a multi-method study.
Mm-hmm. And what'd you learn?
So, you know, I have to admit that one of the most striking findings in the book is something I never saw coming, mm-hmm. which is the importance of finding something to be about, something we call the identity project. So we went in as urban sociologists hoping to understand all these structural kind of top-down forces. You know, the role of neighborhoods, the role of schools, you know, the yeah. role of you know, the labor market, and what kept coming back in this bright, strong way was a sort of a bottom-up sense of what life was like, and in particular, how these young people define themselves in relationship to all of those structural things. And so, you know, we thought we'd write a book about neighborhoods and schools, and we did. But we also wrote a book about the significance of finding something you're passionate about, finding something that allows you to say, I'm not about that life, meaning the street, right? So we found during adolescence, it's not surprising to hear, adolescents and young adults talking about identity. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, developmentally rich period. You know, Eric Erickson told us this a long time ago. Right. But what we saw was that this identity work, you know, whether it's a, you know, hobby, an art outlet for art or social activities or, you know, a professional experience, an internship. What we saw this in many colors. Whatever it was, it wasn't just a developmental task. It was about survival, in a way that young people managed to get to the starting gate, so to speak, of adult life. And the reason this was so meaningful is it was the biggest predictor in our study of being, quote, on track by the time we left these young adults working or in school or both. The striking thing we found about their lives relative to their parents is that they made enormous gains with respect to education and important behavioral domains. You know, for example, only about a third of these young people had a caregiver who had achieved a high school diploma or equivalent, the GED, yet over 70% of these young adults finished high school. Mm-hmm. You know, 13% had a parent enter trade school or some kind of college, yet 50% of the young men and women we met had done that, which was 70% of the high school grads. You know, half these kids grew up with a parent addicted to drugs or alcohol. Half had a parent incarcerated at some point. Two-thirds had one or the other of these risk factors. A third had both. Yet by the end of our study, fewer than one out of five young adults had turned to the street. They had, you know, they had nearly universally heeded the call of work and school, right? This sort of American narrative, despite growing up with so much risk. And imagine this, while we're writing the book, you know, Freddie Gray dies. And Baltimore is, you know, an upheaval. And all you can see on television are images of these, you know, these few you young adults and older adults throwing bricks or you know, hitting a police car, giving the impression that the exception is the norm, when we find, of course, precisely the opposite.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are obviously all kinds of possible explanations you might turn to for why it is that these young folks seemed, all else equal, to be doing pretty well, and certainly exceedingly well compared to what the public image of, you know, teens and young adult African-Americans living in a place like Baltimore. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the range of possible explanations for how we might account for their relative well-being? And then I want to turn back to talking about the ways in which they may not be still doing so well. And then why it is that you all think that this notion of the identity project is the most satisfying of those range of explanations.
Yeah, let me try another way of coming at that question, which is, you know, there's an intergenerational explanation and then there's a within generation explanation. So, you know, these intergenerational changes that we saw, we argue in large part were due to the MTO intervention itself, plus the demolition of the high-rise public housing project. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is that, you know, these families were you know, they were in our study because they had signed, you know, they were living in some of the highest poverty neighborhoods in America. You know, that in Baltimore was one of the cities that had put in for the proposal to be part of the Moving to Opportunity experiment. You know, so they were living in neighborhoods where the poverty rates exceeded 50%, right? And your typical average, you know, poverty rate in the United States hovers between, depending on the numbers, you know, anywhere from 11 to 14%, right? So these are extremely high poverty neighborhoods, extremely high, you know, high violence neighborhoods. So through the MTO program, which provided vouchers and some housing counseling to leave these neighborhoods in move to neighborhoods where poverty rates were less than 10%, right? So this was part of what happened. You know, partially, you know, we saw that the families who signed up and got that, you know, moved to these neighborhoods that were remarkably different. But the families that were part of the experiment known as the control group that didn't get anything were living in housing projects that would then be demolished anyway. And, you know, things in Baltimore were so dire by the early 90s that the HOPE6 program and the MTO program both came here. And so what we saw is everybody left the projects. And there was virtually nowhere at that time worse, right, in Baltimore. And so these young people came up and, you know, spent part of their childhoods in neighborhoods that were much lower poverty than their parents came up in, and then their older siblings, you know, grew up in. And, you know, we think in part there was a neighborhood effect for all of these young adults. And this manifested itself in two ways. One was that they were, you know, in safer neighborhoods. They reported feeling safer. There were lower rates of victimization in their families. We heard this both from young adults and their parents. They were exposed to a wider array of adults, far more working neighbors, far fewer single parent headed families, more educated neighbors. So we think there was sort of a direct effect of being in a different kind of environment. Two, the mental health benefits I mentioned earlier, you know, that came through in the 5-city big, you know, MTO experimental evaluation. We also saw in our deeper dive field work, several dozen mothers, you know, told us that they quit drinking and doing drugs after they left the projects and started feeling like they could parent the way they'd always wanted to parent. There was a parenting dividend with this, you know, with this, you know, mental health dividend and also some, you know, reduction in substance abuse. And so you had this kind of newfound efficacy among some of the women. You know, Tammy was the mother of a young man named Antonio, who's in her book, and she said that when she was living in the Flag House projects, that it felt like she was trapped, caged, and worthless, living in an atmosphere of absolutely no progress, where no one encouraged no one. Those are Tammy's words, and she said, I'll admit, I didn't discipline my kids all that much because living there was a punishment. And when she moved to a safer, less poor neighborhood in Northeast Baltimore, she said, you know, we were able to then focus on routines and family life and having meals. And so we heard this over and over again, that women said, I was finally able to see what it was like to raise my kids in a positive environment. It made me want more. So you had several different things going on under this idea of neighborhood effects, which helps us explain, we argue, this intergenerational gain in say educational outcomes. Now, we were still left with a question of what explains, you know, how about 80% of the young people were in school or working or both by the time they left our study. Yet we had, you know, about 20%. Of the youth disconnected, right? As some of the some scholars call it, right? Not involved in mainstream institutions, like school or, you know, the labor market. What explains that? And this is where the Identity Project comes in. Now, all of these young people were in our study, because of their shared origins, which were disadvantaged, not because they were, you know, the cream of the crop, and not because they were, you know, hanging on the corner, right? We have quite a range of outcomes for in pathways in this sample. But what we saw is that origins were very, very similar. What we could observe and predict things on the basis of were really similar. But the one thing that seemed to sort of come through was whether they cultivated an identity project. About half the youth did. It looked like this was the biggest predictor of being on track. Of course, you know, many young people who didn't have what we could identify as an identity project managed to finish high school and stay off the streets. But this cultivation of a passion project of you know, an identity project really seemed to make a big difference.
But that was no guarantee, right?
That they'd find one?
The mere presence of an identity project was not necessarily. I guess what I'm getting at is that I worry that some folks might read the book as evidence that, well, see, we've been saying this all along. If you simply write, work hard enough, and if you try hard enough, that's all you have to do, and you can overcome any of these supposedly structural obstacles that are in your way. That is not the argument that you are making, right?
Right, and it's interesting, you know, to think about it like that, because again, during the time where we were, you know, in the field and in analyzing the data, there was all of this discussion around grit that came up.
Yeah.
You know, Angela Duckworth research, you know, and you know, popularized by Paul Tough's book, How Children Succeed. And what we realized is that basically all of the young adults in our study were displaying some kind of grit every day.
Yeah.
It wasn't a matter of finding gritty ones and not the other ones. But you know, what does that really mean in this kind of a setting, right? What does it mean to be gritty, you know, and just surviving the day, you know, versus achieving, you know, a college entrance or something like that? But the insight we found from the identity projects was that the, you know, this idea of grit doesn't just really come out of nowhere. It needs to be inspired and motivated. And what we saw was finding something to be about was often the catalyst. It sparked gritty behaviors around school and professional goals. You know, Tony got an internship through the YouthWorks program here in Baltimore, and he was able to work at the University of Maryland on the school pharmacy campus. He was, you know, sort of, you know, doing mail delivery, but also, you know, specimen delivery. And he got a chance to really be around medical professionals. And he said it was being around them and asking them about what they do and watching some of what they do, and that sparked my interest to become a pharmacist. Mm-hmm. And that set in motion a plan to finish high school. And then he applied to the University of Maryland, and got in, but couldn't afford it. So he went to Baltimore City Community College and decided to try to get some of the prerequisites done in each semester. Has this piece of paper on the fridge, had the requirements written on, and each semester he ticks one of them off, two of them off as he finishes them and puts it back up on the fridge. And so, you know, there is this experience that opened up a sense of something he could be and something he could be excited about. And that we all know what this feels like. Mm-hmm. It's important to have meaning and joy and excitement and purpose. And that makes it a lot easier to persevere toward long-term goals, as Duckworth defines grit.
Yeah. And you also emphasize the importance of there being an institutional location to channel that identity project. Can you talk a little bit about the ways in which that plays out and how important that is?
Yeah, and I'll say, you know, just a little more on that. I mean, I think you're right. I think, you know, there's a slippery slope in saying, well, if kids find these things to be about, and, you know, this is what allows them to succeed. But I think it's important because, you know, it I think gives us some action items to say, mm-hmm. We can provide opportunities and raw material for them to find, you know, to find something that they want to devote their lives to, and less so in youth policy, especially for non-college bound youth. And so I think what it does is gives us a window into how we can make a difference in the lives of young adults who are typically thought of as lost causes already. So that's just, you know, one thing I think is important, you know, to emphasize that this isn't just about accountability testing in school. You know, it's about all of the other things that we've leached out of our schools, you know, art, music, debate, you know, community organizations that provide rich experiences. So this is, you know, sure, a naive reading of this is, you know, one where it's just kids' assessments. Now, you know, so we found a couple of different kinds of identity projects, and not all of them are so institutionally based. Some of these are just things that young people do alone to escape rather than engage, to protect and withdraw rather than, you know, to connect with mentors and other peers. You know, Vicky builds pigeon coops in her backyard and tends to these pigeons as a way to diffuse bouts of anger that she has that she can't explain or control. You know, Dana was videotaping herself in her bedroom with her dad's old VCR, reading her poems aloud, but it would be years before she would do this in high school and she felt more comfortable. And so, you know, these sort of do-it-yourself identity projects are a lot less predictive of transitions to college and work, but they still serve an important purpose in the near term. I think the institutional story is powerful, right? And this brings to mind. You know, things like career academies and career exploration and training, which, as we show later in the book, is something that these young people have so little of that they turn to for-profit schools to get at very, very high cost and very low yield.
Yeah. There's just sort of as a footnote, we spoke with Tressie McMillan Cottom a couple of weeks ago about her book, Lower Ed, which is precisely about those for-profit institutions and the kinds of people who are most likely to turn toward them. And there's sort of very interesting overlap here about the ways in which we produce people who are vulnerable to that kind of exploitation. We tell them that this is your way out, but we close off so many of those opportunities, and we make even public universities in some places still wind up being unaffordable and hard to access. So we create this kind of bind even for those young people with passion and ambition.
Exactly. No, exactly. You know, it's there's a convergence now. You know, Tressie's book is really important in this regard. And, you know, when we went into the field, my thought was everyone's going to be aiming for four-year colleges, right? This sort of college for all frenzy. And we're going to see it, you know, low-income students who, right, may not have the resources or the academic preparation thinking they still, right, they need to go to a four-year school. I mean, I at the time when we started this, I thought that was going to be one of the biggest patterns. And I was surprised to find out that, right, the modal pathway into higher education for the young people that we talked to in Baltimore was a for-profit school. You know, of course, followed by a close second community college. But I think that this hunger to launch, this desire to be someone and to, you know, to fill any of these professional aspirations, right? This is so strong. And then you get this, right? These young people are so vulnerable because they're ready to launch and do this. They don't have the scaffolding that middle class young adults have, which is to, you know, experiment with a gap year or, you know, try to go to this school and see if it doesn't work, you transfer. They know, the young adults in Baltimore know that they're in many ways on their own. And so they think, what's the quickest way to get stable? And what's the quickest way to do something, you know, that I can tell people I can do, right? This is this sense of identity, and there are two ways to do it. One is to go right into the labor market, which many young men did in our study. You know, of course, we saw, you know, quite a few more young women go into higher education than young men, which is consistent with national trends. You know, but many of the young men tried entering into you know, low-wage service sector jobs quickly, and but many also tried these for-profit schools, and we saw many young women entering right into the certified nursing assistant programs and phlebotomy programs, because the commercials say you can have the certification in 12 months or 18 right. months. And then there's pictures of professionals in offices doing things with dental equipment. And mm-hmm. and they think, oh, okay, I can do this. It's quick. And, you know, in and out. And you know, before you know it, and that's what I need is what a young woman, Ashanti,
says. As Tressie shows, those institutions often do an exceptionally good job of making that easy, of getting you enrolled and getting you started very, very quickly, which, you know, arguably some of those more traditional institutions that we've been parts of, they may not be as good at because they are not as committed to serving those student populations.
Right. I mean, and Tressie, you know, talks about this more than we do. You know, the recruitment efforts on the part of these for-profit schools are incredible. You know, the money they spend on advertising and recruitment dwarfs many big companies like Starbucks and you know, Wendy's or, you know, I mean, it's a lot. There's a big commitment to the upfront recruitment. And as we saw in the SEC inquiry and, you know, this case against Corinthian colleges, yep. right, that they, you know, staff admitted that they targeted young people with low self-esteem who felt vulnerable and, you know, didn't have a long-term plan. I mean, there's a very vulnerable sense of, you know, who they were going after. And in some ways, that describes the, you know, the young adults in Baltimore that we met. Yeah. But, you know, and part of what's happening here is that you have, right, young people who are doing the right thing. They're trying to make a way for themselves. And, you know, they launch quickly. And even if the, you know, the for-profit schools worked well, we'd still have this issue of this quick launch and this, you know, the structural context of having to commit to a program of study before you've had time to explore your interests. And so, you know, a young man named Jackson said, well, I didn't know, right, that doing medical assisting, you'd have to use needles and put needles in people. And it was nerve-wracking. I couldn't do it. And so he quit and tried something else, right? The idea that you know, what these programs mean, what it would look like, how much it's going to cost to go, what the jobs will eventually pay, they have no idea.
So let's talk a little bit. We're speaking with Stephanie DeLuca, co-author of Coming of Age and the Other America. And we have been talking about young men and women in Baltimore who have surprised a lot of researchers and others by doing just fine, all things considered, and certainly not living lives consistent with some of the uglier public images of them, but nonetheless are facing some considerable obstacles toward upward mobility, toward getting into jobs that are going to allow them to pursue those passions in ways that are perhaps more lucrative than they might otherwise be. So we think about sort of the lessons of your book. What should Baltimore be doing, particularly in terms of public policies, in terms of things that are practical, and then maybe talk sort of about larger national policies that you think ought to be on our radar?
So I think, you know, that Baltimore right now is in a bit of a, you know, a struggle. We have a new mayor. You know, we have a police department under consent decree. You know, we have voters who just approved something called a child and youth fund, Baltimore City Child and Youth Fund, that puts aside $12 million a year to invest in young people. And so what you have here is an opportunity. Right. But you also have a tension between whether the answer to what's happening in Baltimore is to police differently or to invest in youth differently. Right. And so these are, you know, not mutually exclusive strategies, but I think it's tough, you know, in the shadow of what's happening with crime and in, you know, this sort of larger fear among Baltimore residents about the young adults who live in our poorest neighborhoods. This, you know, there's this tension between, you know, how do we, you know, talk about these young people as assets instead of threats? Yeah. And this is, you know, this is about leadership and politics. And so I see an opportunity and, you know, this, the Child and Youth Fund is new. A task force has just been assembled. And, you know, I hope to be able to work with them and provide some direction. So this is one area, right, where we, you know, we went into the field after the unrest in the spring of 2015, while we were still writing this book, to do kind of a rapid response look at young adults in the neighborhoods where most of the activity was taking place. They call it the riots. These are not the words everybody likes to use, but this is their language. You know, the neighbors that were most affected by the unrest and the riots, you know, Mundamin, Sandtown, Winchester, Upton, Penn North, and, you know, ask them what they thought about what had happened. What do they think about the police, the city, their futures? And we heard a very sort of a brutal and sobering set of accounts that really converged on one story, which is a story of abandonment and neglect. Mm-hmm. That these young adults felt like there was no way for them to become who they wanted to be in Baltimore as it was now. So much so that of the 60 young adults we talked to that summer, not one planned to stay here. And so, you know, there's a sense that Baltimore has, as this young man Jaden said, you know, become a setup city. They set you up to fail here. And so I think that what you know, we're hearing from these young adults more recently in the wake of this very, you know, tense period where they're finally going, oh, now people are paying attention to us. You know, there's this sense that the rec centers have been closing, that there aren't enough jobs. There's, you know, not enough raw material to create oneself, as Rhiannon, this young woman Rhiannon says. So we're hearing a lot of that. And yet what we found, of course, in our book is that if young people can find some of these things, it can be game changing. So, you know, we're hearing a bunch of directions for Baltimore. And I think the city has to make some tough choices about whether it wants to devote more of its attention to policing young people differently versus investing in them as the city's future and it's some of its biggest assets.
Are you hopeful?
So I'm hopeful because I've never seen so many conversations in Baltimore around the, you know, around what to do. Every day there's a new group that's forming and a new set of conversations that is happening. And I've lived here for 15 years, you know, so it's almost been kind of my hometown. I'm from Chicago originally. So, but it's been, I've never seen, these conversations happening to this extent. Now, whether they will come together and produce fruit, whether, you know, local politics won't get in the way, I'm not sure. I'm really not sure, but I think, I guess the best way to describe how I feel is that we're in a moment and we have to make some tough choices. Yeah. I'm optimistic because I see what young people in West Baltimore have been able to accomplish. Yeah. I'm optimistic about the raw material we have to work with. But, you know, I obviously feel some ambivalence about whether we're going to be able to do what needs to be done.
Yeah. And I will say that I mean, I did walk away from Coming of Age in the Other America with the feeling that it really was a very hopeful book. I mean, it's filled with, you know, an extraordinary number of amazing young people. And that, you know, sort of always give me hope that even under extraordinarily adverse circumstances, so many of them finding ways against all odds to make lives that will give them some kind of satisfaction. It felt like, anyway, that sort of permeated the book for me, was that sort of sense that there really is a real disservice that we have done to young people of color, in particular in the United States, in the ways that they get talked about in public discourse, and that really betrays the reality of them in their lives.
You know, I think that's right. And I'm encouraged to hear you say that, to, you know, you can walk away from the book with lots of things, but I think it also was a struggle, right, to celebrate what they have managed to accomplish, but yeah, also point out is that, you know, it's hard to say, is this, you know, this is success by,
right,
other measures because this, again, the intergenerational part of this is, you know, different from the inequality part of this. Right. So you have this we see, you know, intergenerational gains, you know, as a result of housing policy, which tells us, you know, that the transmission, you know, of disadvantage is not inevitable. We can interrupt it if we invest. However, you know, there's also this question of inequality and separate and unequal spaces. And, you know, so I think that part of the trick is to say what Cody, for example, has accomplished by graduating high school, the only person in his family to have done so, is, you know, that's a huge win. Now, high school is the starting block, right? For, I mean, we know what the earnings premium is for a bachelor's degree. So how do these young people compare to their middle class peers? Well, you know, my colleague and dear friend Carl Alexander, you know, and Doris Entwistle and Linda Olson wrote a book called The Long Shadow about a generation of Baltimoreans about 10 years older than those we talked to, and they had higher income and lower income young people that they followed for a quarter century. And, you know, they show that in many ways, right, that this family level inequality does persist. And, you know, about 45% of the higher income young adult, you know, youth that they then, you know, children that they've unfollowed from first grade through to their early 30s, you know, about 45% of the higher income adults had a bachelor's degree, and only 4% of those who started out in poor families ended up with a bachelor's degree. So this is an inequality story that is powerful and important to remember in some of, you know, when we think about some of this optimism. But I think our book sort of shows under the hood all of these ways that things are made possible. And, you know, if we want to invest, that there is not an inevitability to family as destiny.
And as you pointed out earlier, it's not hopeless too, right? Because so much of the literature on child poverty really has suggested that if you are not making those kinds of investments in very early childhood, then it is exceedingly difficult to do anything down the road. And I think this pushes back against that a little bit and says, no, there are in fact strategic investments that we could be making in young people that will bear fruits for them and for their communities.
I think that's right. I mean, that is certainly one thing we're pushing back on. I mean, we can't deny the fact that investing early goes very far. But Belle Sawhill and her colleagues at the Brookings Institution have written about, you know, invest early and often. Yeah. And have shown if we take best practices interventions from early childhood through to adolescence and play all of them, right, we can, you know, there can be enormous returns on that investment and quite a bit of social mobility. I think, you know, this idea that kids from Baltimore and not just youth this period of life, but youth in Baltimore, you know, who people become familiar with through The Wire or through these viral but limited stories in the media, right? There's a sense that there is a hopelessness, and it's easy to write them off. And I think, you know, obviously you've talked about some of this in your own work and you know, the sort of myths around the poor. And I think that what is so important to remember is that at a time when we have such high levels of economic segregation and still tenacious levels of racial segregation, right? It makes it easy for people in different social classes and in different races to become strangers to each other because we don't live together, and we don't go to school together. And when you have, you know, big gulfs like that, I mean, these peak levels of segregation by residents, you know, then you're vulnerable to poor sources of information, say about the poor, right? If you're a middle-class person and not in these neighborhoods and not without any real world, you know, exposure. And it's easy then to say, oh, this extreme that we see on television or the most aggravating and threatening aspects of inner city life that get put on the news, this is the norm. And then it becomes easy to say these kids are threats. These kids are those kids, not our kids, as Robert Putnam calls them, not our kids. And then it becomes difficult to garner policy support, and it engenders a zero sum game way of thinking about public policy that I think is corrosive. Even in the face of good ideas about what to do and evidence-based policy, how do we build support? And I think, you know, part of what we hope to do in the book, but also I think is the role of good journalism and you know, well-disseminated social science and, you know, all kinds of policy innovations, you know, try to think about how we do this. But I think it's a key piece here to keep in mind.
So what are you working on next?
So we are working on a number of different things here. I co-run the Poverty and Inequality Research Lab here at Hopkins with Kathy Eden, and our team of incredible graduate students, postdocs, and undergraduate students. We are working on a few projects that are related to some of the themes in the book. I'm studying another major housing intervention here in Baltimore, the Baltimore Housing Mobility Program, that was launched similar to that Chicago program, launched out of a class action desegregation lawsuit in the 90s, where Baltimore public housing families sued the Housing Authority of Baltimore City and HUD for segregating them in you know, the poorest and most racially isolated communities in Baltimore. This case came to a liability decision in 2005, and then I testified in the remedial phase. And as a result of that, began to get to know the program, and then got access to the data and started to follow the now nearly 3,000 families in inner city Baltimore who have moved to more affluent neighborhoods and school districts across central Maryland. And so we are following those families over time. Now we've been doing that for about 12 years, looking at children's achievement in school and, you know, largely focused on that transition to school and the effects of being in higher resource schools and safer neighborhoods. We are also launching a study of post-secondary decisions among disadvantaged youth in Baltimore. You know, this for-profit, the popularity of the for-profit schools got me really thinking. Is this, you know, choice? And we find in the book, you know, it's based in part not on maybe not necessarily on poor information about the benefits of a bachelor's degree, but on good information about how likely it is that bad things will happen to you over the course of 4 years. So you might as well try to get something done now, right? This expectation of negative shocks as part of the decision-making process is a very different way to think about investments in higher education. And so I'm working with an economist here, Nick Papageorge, and an economist at American University, Seth Gershenson, to combine insights from behavioral modeling and economics and our insights in sociology to really get a sense of what beliefs are about the payoffs to different educational investments, why young people, you know, invest differently at you know, thinking about the sub-baccalaureate level versus the four-year level. And we're partnering with the Baltimore City Community College and the College and Career Readiness Division of the city schools to try to help, you know, have an iterative process of what's going on the ground and what, you know, and what we're learning. And so I'm very excited about that. That's just in the hopper. A third main area is looking at neighborhood change and revitalization in Baltimore. There are a lot of neighborhoods in Baltimore where there's new investment and, you know, high poverty neighborhoods that have seen very little activity now getting some investment while others don't. You know, why does that happen? Who's moving in? You know, what are some of these decisions being made by property owners and developers and residents? And so, you know, it's a different way of coming at place and saying, well, how does place change, as opposed to just what happens when people move into different places?
We have been speaking with Stephanie DeLuca. She is the co-author with Susan Clampett Lundquist and Catherine Eden of Coming of Age in the Other America from the Russell Sage Foundation. Stephanie, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much, Stephen. The pleasure is all mine. I'm glad to be here.